three elementary questions that a lot of us have been thinking about since we were very little that really drive a lot of fundamental science are: what are we, where did we come from, and are we alone? So obviously, these are drivers for much of fundamental science, and they're the driving questions for particle physics. And particle physics over the last century has made a lot of inroads in all three of these. So in particular, we've seen a huge transformation in our understanding of what we are, from the periodic table to the electronic structure of the atom, to the theories that we now have that unify the description of fundamental matter and fundamental forces. The most remarkable thing, though, about figuring out what we are is that in the process of doing that, we've uncovered really deep principles and powerful ideas that seem to be at work in nature. And that's a pretty non-trivial thing. It's pretty remarkable that actually works. But importantly, we're not done with that process. We're not done at all. In fact, I think we're not even close to being done. So what particle physics is about right now is about continuing this process on, continuing to figure out what we are, and in the process, discovering new principles. So going a little bit further, though, we've been able to take what we are, sort of knowledge of what we are, and by we, I mean particle physicists, cosmologists, astronomers, astrophysicists, a wide range of fundamental physicists, many others, and we've been able to use that information to piece together a very sharp, coherent picture for where we come from. So for example, we've been able to use our knowledge of the structure of atoms and the behavior of hot plasmas to figure out quantitatively what the cosmic microwave background tells us about the origins of our universe, just to name one example. We can also take knowledge of nuclei and nuclear physics as a whole to obtain a precise quantitative understanding of the primordial origin of the light elements. And not just that, but also just the very processes that drive stars. Now, this process of taking knowledge about what we are, applying it to figuring out where we come from, it's come full circle. And it's brought into very sharp focus a number of puzzles that really touch on both of these. For example, we're made of matter, not antimatter, but we don't have a verified explanation for where that fundamental asymmetry comes from. Even more striking than that is that when you look out in the universe, the vast majority of it is made out of stuff that we're not made out of. So we haven't even figured out what the universe is made of. We figured out what we're made of. We figured out what the planet's made of, what a lot of visible matter is made of. But most of it, we haven't done that yet. So that makes now an especially exciting time to be doing fundamental science in general, okay? So we know that we're not alone. There's more left to be discovered. There's more clues, there's more key ingredients. So I just mentioned there's a wealth of evidence for dark matter and dark energy. We don't know what it is. We don't know why it's there. We don't know how it works. We want to figure out where the matter comes from. And if you look in even further detail, nuts and bolts of the Standard Model, for example, you look at the fact that neutrinos have mass. That's another feature of just the nuts and bolts of the Standard Model that hint towards new physics, perhaps at a very high scale. And then famously, of course, there's good theoretical reasons to think that unifying some of the fundamental forces like gravity with quantum mechanics will require new physics. So the central challenge of particle physics right now is to make first contact with the physics responsible for addressing many of these puzzles, any of them. Okay? And the main sort of takeaway message from this talk is that we have a multitude of opportunities to do that. There's a wide number of things that we can do experimentally to go off and actually address these puzzles. And this is important. We have barely started, okay? This is really an amazing time. Now, many of you have seen particle physics in the news recently, so I want to start here and give you a snapshot of where the field is at right now. So the Large Hadron Collider, this is the largest collider in human history, and there's experiments there, the largest ever performed, have been used to explore nature at absolutely the smallest scales ever looked at. And experimenters there recently discovered the first instance of a fundamental particle that doesn't look like it has spin, spinless, no angular momentum. And if you look closely at this, upon closer inspection, it looks like this particle is in fact a Higgs boson, the particle responsible or associated with the breaking of fundamental electroweak symmetry in the standard model, giving rise on the one hand to very short distance microscopic weak interactions, and on the other hand to long-range electromagnetism. And also, very likely, giving mass to particles like the electron so that atoms in the universe can exist in a stable configuration. Now, there were plenty of good reasons, largely based on consistency of how the standard model works, to think that we would find something like a Higgs boson at the Large Hadron Collider. But there were also good reasons, good theoretical reasons, to think that there should be more physics, and in particular that there should be some kind of mechanism that very concretely explains the origin and vast separation of the fundamental scales that we know about in nature. So this was alluded to in the challenge discussion before, so let me just talk about it just a little bit, okay? So this is the weak scale on the one hand, so far beneath the Planck scale, and so far above the cosmological constant. Those may not be the only scales. There may be others. There may be scales associated with dark matter. There may be scales associated with the resolution of the minuteness of CP violation in the strong interactions or axions. We don't know. But those scales already paint a very clear picture for a puzzle. Many ideas have been addressed to address these puzzles over the years. One in particular, low energy supersymmetry, was particularly compelling in part because it accommodated, in fact predicted successfully, the precise unification of the known forces, the strong, the weak, and the electromagnetic ones at a very high scale. And supersymmetry and other ideas have also had enough structure in them to address many other puzzles in the standard model. So that was kind of the expectation, that some rich mechanism would blow up in our face as soon as the Large Hadron Collider turned on. That was one of the expectations. There were others. At this point, and this is where it gets exciting, okay? This is why it's really great to be doing this kind of physics now. We have this wealth of data that's poured in, and the LHC has now tested the most predictive forms of naturalness, the mechanisms that realize naturalness. There's many ways to put this, but at some level, it looks like the most predictive forms are just plain wrong. Now, there's a lot of things that can be said about this. We don't know if this underlying idea that there should be a mechanism is approximate. We don't know if we're missing some important ingredient, and we've just started to look. But this is clearly already a very significant breakthrough. There's absolutely no doubt about that. This data is very, very squarely confronting the wisdom of the field. It's challenging the wisdom of the field. And we clearly have something to learn from this. And this is really the example of the kinds of physics I want to talk about in the rest of this talk. I mean, this is transformative stuff, all right? The discovery of the Higgs has also opened up a completely new field, one where we can now use the Higgs to address more precisely than ever exactly how the weak scale works, where it comes from, and its more detailed properties. All right, now this is actually all I'm going to say about the high energy frontier, okay? I'm going to move on, and that's in part because this is just one piece of a much bigger story, okay? What we really care about at the end of the day are the three big questions I mentioned at the beginning, and those questions compel us to figure out what comprises most of the universe, to figure out whether or not there's other fundamental forces, and many other questions like that. But there's sort of, I want to go back to this thing that we discussed before lunch and at lunch, and it was a very, it was quite a fun conversation. About simplicity and about predictiveness. So simplicity in particular is something that particle physicists in the past have been badly burned on, okay? So going back to the 1920s and 1930s, you know, the simplest theory that we had, the theory that actually explains most of the phenomena we see in the world, the vast majority of it, is quantum electrodynamics. Okay, you have an electron, a proton, and a photon. That does it. So one notion of simplicity might just be that it should be the fewest number of degrees of freedom possible. And that was a very popular, widely held belief for what simplicity would look like in particle physics. So then people kept pushing on QED, doing higher precision tests, looking for new things, okay? QED is amazing. It was really resilient. It kept holding up, okay? We didn't find anything. So people became increasingly confident in this picture that simplicity was equal to fewest number of degrees of freedom. And then bam, okay, we started getting hit with new degrees of freedom, new mesons, a whole tower of crap, all right? Junk. Sorry, I'm going to call it junk. So then people started thinking, well, okay, maybe simplicity is wrong. Maybe the QED as a theory is just as a sort of template for a theory is just not a good starting point. And as many people know, the S-matrix program was born out of this as one strategy to try to deal with it. And that was the widely held approach to dealing with that problem, okay? It failed. In fact, very ironically, it came full circle. It turned out QED wasn't such a bad template after all. And we did find, at the end of the day, a relatively simple explanation for this big mess of things. It was a simple explanation. So the lesson of all of this, I think, and there's many other examples like this, is that as people, we should be very careful not to conflate simplicity of principles with the simplicity of the actual physics we see. Okay? These are different things. So that's why there's been a little bit of caution to sort of read too much into exactly what you should expect based on the principle of simplicity. Okay? Is it that the principle should be extremely simple and then there should just be minimal implementations of that? Or is it that it should be the fewest number of degrees of freedom? It's not really clear. Now, at this point, given the data we have from the LHC and other experiments, it's very clear that what we've seen is certainly simpler than what we expected, by many measures, okay? What we don't yet know, though, is whether or not that's the whole story, or whether or not that's what's happening because we just haven't looked very hard. Obviously, if you don't look, everything's gonna be pretty simple. You're just not gonna see things. And that's kind of the state of affairs right now. We've just started. All right, so I'm gonna move on. There's a whole array of questions to address in the universe, and it's not all about the energy frontier. It's not all about high energy physics. There are an absolute wealth of experimental opportunities to address these big questions associated with dark matter, associated with new forces, axions, long-range physics, whole wealth of things. And these all touch on questions of naturalness, they touch on questions of unification, and they touch on questions about where the standard model comes from. And they call for experiments that are not necessarily the high energy ones. So I'm gonna only touch on a few things here. So this is actually gonna be an extremely biased talk, all right? I'm gonna talk about things that I'm most familiar with and that are relatively close to me. But everybody at PI is involved in this kind of physics, and we're all involved in high energy physics as well, okay? So these kinds of topics, they're going to become increasingly important over the next 10 to 20 years, and there's a very simple reason for that. Most of them rely on experiments that are small, cheap, relatively quick, and much more exploratory in character. Much more physics in the tradition of, say, Faraday and Rutherford than in the tradition of the big several thousand person collaborations that we see now. That's not a good or a bad thing, it's just a fact. It's also true that this is an area that PI has been particularly influential in, okay? People in doing particle physics at PI have played a very active role in spearheading a lot of the new experimental approaches that can address questions of dark matter and new forces and axions and so on. So let's start with dark matter. So again, kind of sticking with this theme of simplicity versus complexity. Dark matter raises very zeroth order questions about the universe. Is it simple? Is it just like us? Is it like a neutrino that just has weak interactions? Or is it more complex, like an atom, you know, or a nucleus? Those would be examples of slightly more complex things that it could be. Where did it come from, and what else can it teach us? Now, the starting point, the starting assumption that we've had for many years now is that dark matter is basically just like us. It's like a neutrino that carries weak interactions. And in particular, it's like a simple particle that interacts with us, okay? That's a good starting assumption. So let me tell you about it. The reason that's a nice starting assumption is that it opens up the possibility for a really simple explanation for the origin of dark matter. And that is that particles in the early universe at high temperature can interact with one another and create dark matter. Dark matter can annihilate. As the universe expands, dark matter dilutes, and eventually dark matter particles can't see, they basically stop running into one another, and so you're left with some residual abundance. This is called the thermal weakly interacting massive particle, or WIMP for short. Now, the details of this mechanism, that doesn't actually rely so much on the particle being a neutrino with just weak interactions, but it does rely on a particle interacting with the standard model. Okay? So the simplest explanation relies on some kind of particle interacting with the standard model if you're going to have some new matter. That interaction with the standard model then gives you the opportunity to go off and look for dark matter. And the experiments that do this are detectors that are situated deep underground, and they look for dark matter particles in the halo to come passing through the Earth and then scatter off nuclei in the detectors. They deposit some energy, and you look for that. Okay? Now, these experiments to date have not uncovered conclusive evidence for dark matter scattering in their detectors. There are some experiments with excesses of events, but we don't have conclusive evidence for a positive signal yet. Now, that's actually extremely interesting. Starting with this very simple assumption that it's a particle just like us, like a neutrino in particular, that would correspond to one of these detectors seeing a scattering rate that's at the top of this plot. So what is this plot, I should tell you? It's blurry. On the x-axis, this is the mass of a would-be dark matter particle. The y-axis corresponds to a scattering rate in these detectors, and the units don't really matter. The area above these different curves, those are the areas that are excluded by these experiments now. The simplest possibility of a neutrino-like dark matter candidate lives at the very top of the plot where the Z label is. That's a particle scattering through the Z. That's been tested. It's not true. It doesn't work. Okay? Now, you could still have a particle like us that doesn't scatter predominantly through the Z. It could scatter through something like the Higgs. We've just found the Higgs. Or it could scatter through loops of the W. And that sits lower on this plot, where the Higgs and W loops are. But you, I'll get to that. Let me just tell you. Yeah, it doesn't go down. I'll get there in a second. So dark matter particles that interact with the Higgs, the natural expectation for those rates, that's an area where current experiments are exploring right now, and they're starting to test that. Okay, and then finally, you could scatter through loops of W, so a really high order process. That will be probed by the next generation of these experiments, okay? But the punchline of all of this is already at this point, dark matter searches are straining the kind of just like us, most simple, minimal possibility, all right? So it's really compelling us to consider some other options, some other possibilities. Now, perhaps the simplest one is that dark matter, it is like us, it scatters through weak interactions, but it doesn't scatter elastically. Maybe it just upscatters into a nearby state. Now, in fact, this happens in all the scenarios we know about. Okay, you can, all of the minimal ones, this is totally a viable possibility within these scenarios, and it completely changes the signals. So in particular, if dark matter can't scatter elastically, it has to scatter into a nearby partner, that induces an energy threshold in all these experiments. And remember, dark matter particles in the halo, if they're weighing tens or hundreds of GeV, we expect them to be very slow moving. They don't have a lot of kinetic energy. It's very difficult for them to come in and upscatter, especially if it's off a light target, into a nearby state. Now, one cool thing about this possibility of upscattering is that these excited states, they could be excited states, they could be nearby partners, I just want to be very general about this, they could in principle decay back down. So that, for example, gives you an opportunity to look for this kind of scenario. Needs a new idea. So let me highlight one idea that's come out of PI. So this is due to Maxime, Itai, and Neil Weiner. And this is really cool. So what this uses, it uses an existing detector that's already going to be used to study neutrinoless double beta decay, which is highly relevant for neutrino physics. It's called CORI. It'll be underneath Gran Sasso. This detector has really high energy resolution. It can measure things like photons with extremely good energy resolution. And that's interesting because you can put a big shield on one side of this detector, and actually putting it on one side is important. And then what you do is you see if dark matter particles come in, they scatter off the big heavy nuclei in the lead shield. The lead shield acts like a dark matter exciter. And then you use this really high precision detector to look for the decays. So for example, this sort of setup can look for a daily modulation signal and probe things like magnetic dipole transitions and other things of this sort. Let me move on and ask how sensitive are current, and this will come back to your question. How sensitive are current searches to dark matter scattering through new forces? Now, why do I bring that up? Well, it's if we're just talking about a dark matter particle that interacts through the known forces, in particular the weak interactions, we would expect those to be on the right-hand side of this plot, more in the sort of 100 GeV range or sort of tens of GeV, on the heaviest side, because if they're really light, for example, they can show up in the rare decays of Z bosons, they can now show up in rare decays of Higgses. There's various ways we can look for them through rare decays. There's another cosmological reason, and that is that if their thermal abundance would become too large if they're light and they only scatter through heavy mediators. Okay? Now, direct detection is totally going after that side. You see the constraint line. It's very, very powerful in this plot. It dips way down. But all the other constraints at lower mass just taper away. But if dark matter is scattering through a different force, okay, it could be a new mediator, there's really no reason to bias heavy mass. Okay? That's not an option. That there's like no reason to live on the right side of this plot instead of on the left side of this plot. Now, the reason these constraints are so weak at low mass, sort of beneath sort of tens of GeV, goes back to energetics again. Okay? If dark matter particles, they're slow moving. And the amount of energy they can impart on nuclei and electrons and targets decreases as you decrease their mass, because their total energy, kinetic energy is decreasing. So by the time you get down to beneath a few GeV, 10 GeV, there's so little energy that they can leave that what energy they do leave just looks like radioactive background signals in most of these detectors. It's really, really hard to use this approach to look for dark matter. But this is nice, though, because at this lower mass range, you don't have to wait for dark matter to come to you, okay? You can just make it in the lab quite readily, and then you can look for it directly. So in particular, you can make dark matter with masses in this lower range using high-intensity beams, high-intensity electron beams, high-intensity proton beams. You can slam these beams into targets, or sometimes they're known as beam dumps, and various reactions that can produce dark matter in those collisions. You make a secondary beam of dark matter particles, and then you look for dark matter to scatter in a sensitive detector behind these dumps. Okay? You range out all the background, you get rid of it, you stop it, but any secondary beam of dark matter particles, by virtue of their weak interactions, can keep going, and then you can look for their rare scattering in a downstream detector. Now, you can't do this haphazardly. You have to know what to look for. It's a bit of a delicate matter, but it turns out, believe it or not, that we have such high-intensity beams and such sensitive detectors that we can explore a huge fraction of that parameter space at low mass that I just talked about. What's really cool about this is that we're doing it right now, okay? So there's a couple of very concrete options. One is at Fermilab, another is at Jefferson Lab. Fermilab was the former high-energy frontier laboratory. Now they're principally doing important neutrino physics, so they will be. And the proton beam there is used to produce any secondary beam of light dark matter that might exist. And then an existing detector at that lab, Miniboon, which was a neutrino detector, it's this big detector that was originally designed to study neutrinos, it's now being used right now as we speak. They're taking data to look for light dark matter over this mass range. So this has been spearheaded by, it was actually a postdoc at PI a number of years ago, Brian Battelle, as well as Maxime. And using electron beams at Jefferson Lab, also with existing, very small now, these are detectors that are like this big, okay? Very small neutrino detectors, there's an effort underway to look for light dark matter using electron beams. And so you use electron beams and you use proton beams, and you can probe a whole multitude of interactions that might exist between dark matter and ordinary matter. Now remember, probing these interactions is important because that assumption that dark matter interacts with us, that was kind of key to this very simple idea that you just have some thermal relic. Okay, so we really want to go after that. So this is a fantastic opportunity for discovering. Many of these experiments will be operating over, well, right now, and on the time scale of roughly 5 years or so. Both of these ideas, so yes, the simplest ones, absolutely. You could have other mediators like scalars, but I think in many ways the better motivated ones is you just have a new force carrier that just mixes with the photon. That's sort of the simplest mechanism. Okay, so I sort of zoomed in there to give some examples of opportunities, so let me just step back out. So dark matter in principle has quite a bit that it might be able to teach us. Okay, but the basic questions, that's what I wanted to focus on here. Is it simple or is it complex? Yeah. Well, the mediator is actually, the mass of the mediator doesn't matter so much. If you take the sort of combination of these two experimental approaches, you can do searches for light dark matter that don't really care that much about the precise mass of the mediator. It's fairly insensitive to that. In fact, if you want, you could think about it as like, you could just integrate out the mediator and think about it as just some operator you have and you just produce it. The interaction does, in the off-shell case, where you just integrate out a mediator, it does get very weak, but here's where you have to believe me. These beams are so darn powerful that you can overcome that, okay? And you can still explore quite a wide range of parameters. Not TeV, no. No. So it needs to be less than, say, a few GeV. For these particular experiments, if it's heavier than a few GeV, you can use E plus E minus colliders. And then if it's heavier than tens of GeV, then you match onto the high energy experiments. You see, so the whole suite of experiments can cover a very, very wide range of possibilities. No, not to my knowledge. What experiments do you have in mind? There are other experiments that are also directly looking for light force carriers that I'll get to, and there's a previous generation. I'll get to that. So I'll tell you about that. Okay, but just to summarize, and I just gave a snapshot of a couple of these experiments, but this includes high energy experiments, can do this sort of thing. Importantly though, because actually it was up on the list, I think no WIMPs at the LHC was there. I don't want to hassle, but actually not seeing WIMPs at the LHC doesn't really directly tell you in a very powerful way that there aren't WIMPs. The most sensitive experiments are still these direct detection experiments, okay, and they still have a ways to go. But the message I'm trying to send here is that we can really expand the set of physics that we're actually sensitive to, and we can really go after this question of, is the absolute minimal simplest scenario going to work, or are there a few little ingredients that need to be added, okay? It's a sort of zeroth order kind of fork in the road. Okay, now, the existence of dark matter certainly motivates there being new states of matter beyond what we know about. But that very naturally motivates asking the question, are there also new fundamental forces? Okay? Now, obviously, if dark matter is just a particle like us charged in the weak interactions, then no, you could just, maybe dark matter is just part of the standard model. Okay? Ooh, time is flying. Okay, but there's also the possibility that it's just the first piece of a larger dark sector. So let's ask questions about what we know about new forces beyond the strong, weak, and electromagnetic. Now, at this point, given what we actually know about the known forces, we would expect that new forces, by and large, would actually be quite hard to see, basically because symmetries of the standard model insulate us from interacting directly with new force carriers. Even if you have some particle in the dark matter sector, stable or not, charged under a new force, that doesn't mean there's automatically a way to interact with it. But this is where quantum mechanics can actually be quite helpful. If there's any degrees of freedom at any mass scale that know about our forces and any new force, those degrees of freedom, these could be quantum gravity degrees of freedom up near the Planck scale, they can induce quantum mechanical mixing effects. So just to see how this works in one example, for example, you can take a charged particle like the electron. The dotted line here represents a photon, okay, on the left. And then loops of these very, very high mass particles can induce a mixing of the photon with another force carrier. Okay, this simple mechanism is known as kinetic mixing. And because it's a quantum mechanical effect, you would even expect it to be small. Okay, but it's not suppressed by mass, though. It actually can give rise to a dimension 4 interaction. And what you end up with, though, is a situation where one very generic expectation, if there's new forces, is that they might show up in a situation where our particles, our charged matter, like electrons, look like millicharge particles under whatever this new force is. Okay? Again, quantum mechanical, because it's a quantum mechanical effect, you might expect that it would be small. Okay? So then you can produce new force carriers in annihilation, you can produce it in radiation reactions, and you could try looking for these force carriers directly from their decay back into standard model particles. Now, this is the one example of a series of a small number of interactions that, despite standard model symmetries, let us look for new forces. They let us look for new states of matter. Okay, the others involve the Higgs, neutrinos. What I just described is the kinetic mixing with vectors, and there's also axions. And here, too, there's a wide range of experiments actively looking for this type of physics to address the question, are there new forces of nature? They span, going from top to bottom, high energy and not very great sensitivity, but decent sensitivity, to mid-range energy and pretty good sensitivity, to lower energy and darn right awesome sensitivity, okay? By awesome, I mean capable of probing two-loop quantum mechanical mixing. I mean really very sensitive. So one example that's, okay, particularly close to me is APEX. This is an experiment at Jefferson Lab that searches for new forces by looking directly for them to appear in the decays. You produce a new force carrier in a collision of an electron of the fixed target, and you look for the decay of that force carrier. And this uses high-precision spectrometers to measure the particles. Here's a side-on view of the spectrometers. These are actually huge. They're like the size of this room. Okay, so I said it was close to me because Natalia and I, along with two of our collaborators, are the spokespeople for this experiment. This picture was taken after we were, after a very lengthy, long night during the test run. And so I've often said that I had to pull strings to get this experiment to work, and people look at me like, well, what the heck are you talking about? Like, what do you mean, pull strings? And they don't know that what I mean is literally. So if you look closely in this picture, I'm actually pulling threads. These are threads, okay? These are not wires. And I'm switching between a calibration and a data taking mode. Huh? It's radioactive, yeah. All right. So we were able actually to show that an experiment, yeah, I mean, that would not be good to walk up there, so anyway. So actually, if what we were able to show in this test run, though, is that experiments like this can very sensitively look for new forces, actually over a pretty wide range of mass. And for example, in the full experiment, we'll be able to fill in everything in this plot. We can cover by changing settings. And of course, there's other versions of this experiment now in Germany, for example, that can probe a different part of masses, range of masses than is shown here. But the punchline, kind of one way to think about it, is that these experiments, in a few hours of data taking, can achieve what the best experiments could do before in 10 years, okay? A few hours, 10 years, big difference. Okay, and another example is HPS, and this uses a very different technique. This actually looks for, by virtue of their very weak coupling, new force carriers or other exotic particles to travel a small distance and then decay back. Turns out this kind of search, not only is it sensitive to new force carriers, it's sensitive to other types of particles as well, even really rare phenomena in the standard model. Okay, but because I'm running out of time, let me move on. So by pursuing a lot of these experimental opportunities, we can also address not just this question of is dark matter itself as a state of matter simple or complex, but we can also start to go after this question of are there new forces? Is dark matter perhaps associated with new force carriers? Okay. Now that's a very zeroth order question. Obviously, if we rule out all these options, we acquire more evidence than ever that we have something very vanilla, very simple, in fact, so simple that it's even very puzzling. But a discovery in any one of these experiments has the opportunity to open up a new window. For example, if we find new forces, that clearly changes the story for unification. It raises new questions about naturalness, and it can touch on many other topics. Okay, now the final thing I want to touch on here, we've done new matter, new forces. I want to come back to the known forces, okay? Let me just ask this question. So do we have the right theory for known forces? Okay, so the knee-jerk reaction, obviously, and I'm a little self-conscious even putting this question up on the slide, is obviously, yes, we have the right theory for the known forces, okay? Now, okay, that's my reaction for sure. But we have a somewhat checkered past on this particular question. So for example, we spent roughly a couple hundred years in this action at a distance description of long-range forces. Not only was this, by the standards of the day, the paragon of like mathematical beauty, it was ubiquitous, okay? Described electrostatics, magnetostatics, you know, gravity and celestial mechanics, and it was very, very successful, okay? And of course, it took very, very considerable leaps to uncover descriptions like Maxwell, electromagnetism, and GR. And it took considerable leaps for a variety of reasons, but two that stand out. Well, first, the experiments that you actually do to see that you're missing something, they're really not obvious, okay, unless you know what to look for. The other is that the theories themselves were so radically different from their predecessors. Even the basic symmetry principles built in were different. Okay, we're a little more mature now. We know more, okay? We have a much more comprehensive picture of nature. And to borrow a phrase from Feynman, when we ask this question, do we have the right theory of known forces? We ask this question having to wear an extremely tight straitjacket, okay? You know, and the belt and the buttons of this straitjacket are quantum mechanics and relativity. And it's very, very tight. So what does quantum mechanics tell you? Well, it makes very precise statements about how scattering amplitudes, observable scattering amplitudes, have to be related to one another. And that gives you a series of constraints. Relativity tells you something about how observable scattering amplitudes are compared between moving observer, and that gives you a series of constraints. It turns out just those two principles alone, just those tight jacket constraints, are already quite enough to tell you a lot about this question. First thing you learn is that long-range forces, they have to be mediated by massless degrees of freedom. Beyond that, though, the detailed properties of the forces they mediate, the velocity dependence, the repulsive or the attractive character, it turns out that's largely dictated by how the propagating excitations of these forces behave. And in particular, it's related to what kind of spin they carry. Okay? Now that's kind of cool. So for example, helicity zero, particles that don't carry any angular momentum, they have velocity, they give rise to velocity independent forces. This is up to gamma factors, okay? Helicity one gives rise to linear and velocity forces. Helicity two, quadratic. And if you keep applying this straitjacket, quantum mechanics and Lorentz invariance, single helicity three and higher actually can't mediate long-range forces in a consistent manner. So you run into like a roadblock. So that's already very beautiful. We've seen these forces. Not helicity zero, we've seen a massive version of that. Okay, but if you look a little closer and you ask, well, is this really all there is, starting from just these straitjacket principles, quantum mechanics and relativity? What you find is no, it's not. These look like special cases of something a little bit more general. The most general possibility is for a massless particle is that it's a particle, it carries spin labels that are discrete, except that moving observers measure the spins differently. The spin actually transforms, okay? It mixes. Now, this is a lot like a massive particle. A massive particle with spin, if you prepare it, say, in a, like a spin one vector, if you prepare it in a spin one configuration and then you boost it? A boosted observer would describe it as some linear admixture of spin states. Okay? So the most general case actually has spin properties that are like the massive case, except that it's massless. Now, this has been known about since the very beginning almost the very beginning of this subject. Wigner found these. And not a lot is known about them. I don't want to blame it squarely on this, but I can't help but think that part of the reason is the name. The name is continuous spin, okay? And that just conjures up an image of what these things are that couldn't be further from how they actually work. All right? So do we know anything about them? Do we know anything about the known force law? And this is kind of an important question to get at because, I mean, for crying out loud, if we have these basic principles that very tightly constrain the standard model, and you just want to ask the question, what kinds of long-range forces are compatible with that? There should not be an outlier here, okay? So there's a bunch of consistency checks. Now, I'm not going to go through this in detail because I'm running out of time, and there was recently a colloquium on this. But nonetheless, you can apply the same kinds of consistency checks that you could use to kill, say, helicity 3 theories mediating long-range forces, and you find that those arguments identify an almost unique type of CSP scattering amplitude. So CSP is the acronym here I'm going to just use. So that doesn't work. And in fact, you can take the very simplest scattering amplitudes and you can glue them together to build up higher point ones. Okay. So no problem there. But then the other puzzle that sort of hits you in your face when you first learn what these particles are is they have an infinite tower of these polarization states. So clearly that's got to cause a problem, right? Divergent cross-sections, thermodynamics shouldn't make any sense. But here too, these amplitudes, they're so tightly constrained by the amplitudes that satisfy unitarity and Lorentz invariance, they're so tightly constrained that when you do ask, like, what are cross-sections that you would get, you find all the cross-sections are finite, and that's just a consequence of Lorentz invariance. And you also find that there's an approximate thermodynamic limit. Okay, so it's hard to kill it from that point of view. Finally, you could say, well, all right, so this is just fancy S-matrix arguments. Surely, you know, there's some more basic problem. Maybe there's no space-time description. Okay, that doesn't work. In fact, there's a shockingly simple field theory for these things. Fine. So when you put it all together, you do learn quite a few things about if there's a consistent theory, we can now say something about what the force laws would look like, what their properties would be. Now, I should say, this is an open problem. Despite all these consistency checks and building up higher point amplitudes, et cetera, we don't have a completely controlled theory, okay? You know, killing it or showing it that doesn't work is still, that's a big goal here. But what's cool about this is now we can say in complete generality the following, and this is kind of a remarkable fact. No matter what happens, quantum mechanics and Lorentz invariance tells you that force laws, they're always dominated by the type of velocity structure that you see in helicity 0, 1, or 2, and that is it. Okay? There are corrections, and the corrections are controlled by one parameter. It turns out to be a quantum number for these things. And those corrections are all small in a non-relativistic limit. Did I say that this was also testable? Okay, this is about as testable as it gets, in a sense. Actually, the limiting factor is just theoretical control. But all of these effects give effects that show up in radiation, in thermal properties, force laws, etc. And this is something that, you know, this is another example where, as we proceed over the next 10 to 20 years, to sort of carefully check and to carefully think about the theoretical assumptions built into the standard model, these are the kinds of things that we want to just absolutely nail. And if we can't nail these things from first principle, and they're amenable to experimental tests, darn it, we should actually do these experiments, okay? Now, there's a bit more of a story here, but I'm out of time. So I'm going to go ahead and wrap up. So I told you this would be a very biased talk. I only touched on a few things that particle physicists at PI do. Okay, there's many other things. So we've had the newest faculty member to come to PI has had a number of ideas to address looking for axion-like particles. And that physics could potentially be related to very high scales. Cliff and others in the group, they have new ideas, new approaches to the cosmological constant problem using extra dimensions and supersymmetry with testable predictions at the Large Hadron Collider and for long-range force tests. And there's many other things. Okay. In summary, though, there's just two points. Right now, we're in the middle, just kind of the midst, like right in the kind of very hard to orient process of a breakthrough. All right. But what makes me really excited is that we have a whole new generation of opportunities over the next 10 to 20 years to explore dark matter. We can look for new forces. We will continue exploring at the Large Hadron Collider. And beyond the Large Hadron Collider, we'll try to build a higher energy collider on a few decade time scale. Okay? So there's a lot of exploration underway. And PI is playing a pretty important role in this. So thank you.
Okay, so time for a couple of questions.
It's possible that dark matter doesn't exist like the ether, and then the only alternative is that you modify gravity. And modify gravity without dark matter is not without success.
Sorry, was there a question? I just...
All right, let me put a question. First of all, I want to stress that you must continue looking for dark matter, especially the way you do. However, if it doesn't exist, then eventually, in order to fit the data, you have to have a modified gravity. There's no alternative.
I agree with that, absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
Any other questions?
I guess I'm kind of interested about the continuous spin particles that you were talking about. And maybe like the main thing is like, what was the main thing different that you guys have been doing? Because I know there were a lot of older papers that were saying they're not causal theories or something like that. Like, how did you overcome this, the older thing?
So none of the earlier papers actually went that far. What the earlier papers found is that if you try to build a theory of continuous spin using what are known as covariant fields, there's difficulty with implementing what are known as micro, sort of local commutation conditions. Now, I'm going to stop there. If you build a gauge theory, there's no obstruction, though. So if you try to do this in QED, okay, you run into a very similar obstacle, all right? And the resolution ends up being that it's useful to introduce something like a gauge potential so that you can have simultaneously a local description that can describe the right degrees of freedom. But it ends up being a gauge theory. And the resolution to the puzzle that these earlier authors encountered was exactly that. And in fact, the gauge theory we found precisely reduces to the gauge theories that you're used to seeing for spin one and spin two.
Okay, I think we'll have to stop there for the questions. So I'd like to thank Philip again.